looking at the beginning, the theological base of American Protestantism was Calvinism. I point that out. The New England Puritans were reformed in their theology, to a lesser extent the other colonies. We've already talked about covenant theology and how they use that to the paradigm for the construction of the state, so to be a Christian society. But Protestantism went into in the colonial period, there was a period, this is page 137, there was a period of great spiritual and moral decline. This is the important thing I want you to note. The delicate theological distinctions of Calvinism began to blur, emphasis began to be placed on good works done in preparation for salvation. With this dilution of Puritanism, and with war with the Indians, and with trouble with England, and with the bad taste that was left in everybody's mouth at the Salem witchcraft, you've heard of burning the witches at Salem. What happened was that with the fighting the Indians and struggling with mother country, and with these excesses, and with the general decline in theology, the churches went into a period of spiritual decline. Look at some of these early Puritan fathers. They wrote, by 1700, the affairs of the land were dominated more by tavern life than by church life. That's my statement. Most people did not even bother to seek church membership. You realize that period, this early 1700s. Increase Mather wrote, "Oh, New England, tremble, for the glory is going and is gradually departing." What do you mean? See, the New England colonies were set up to be model Christian societies. And what was happening? Christianity, as they defined, was just about gone. Thomas Bacon wrote, "Religion among us seems to wear the face of the country, probably moderately cultivated, the greater part wild and savage." American religion entered into a period of sluggishness. This spiritual state paralleled the situation in England before the time of John Wesley, where gin addiction, rowdiness, and religious indifference were eating away at society. Well, things could not go on, and led by a revival started by men like Theodore Frelinghuysen and Gilbert Tennant, I identify them for you there in the syllabus, produced the first great awakening. George Whitefield, these other men were forerunners, these two men I mentioned were forerunners. There were two men who really led out of the Great Awakening. First, John Whitefield, the second one, Jonathan Edwards. Whitefield, we studied before, made several trips to America, whereas Wesley did not. In the fall of 1740, George Whitefield made a number of remarkable tours, 73 days, 800 miles, 130 sermons in New England. Someone joked that Whitefield could bring an audience to tears simply by pronouncing the word Mesopotamia. He was a very dramatic, emotional fellow. Benjamin Franklin, the venerable scientist, attended a service in Philadelphia in order to measure the number of people Whitefield could speak to at one gathering with his marvelous voice. There's only Ben Franklin goes to hear Whitefield preach just to count off, to strike an arc and strike a circle to see and estimate how many people were there to listen. The rains of the First Great Awakening were falling, and according to historian Edward Gestell, nearly everyone got wet. Jonathan Edwards is the name we think of with this Great Awakening, this First Great Awakening. He was a pastor at Northampton, Massachusetts. He was preaching on the land. He was determined. His church was dead. State church. People came. If they didn't come, they were rowdy. They would talk and visit during the sermon. Very little piety. And he was determined he was going to change things. He went through a period of fasting and prayer. He came into the pulpit one day all charged up. And he preached on the wrath of God. And while he was preaching, the gallery, like the balcony, the gallery of these little churches fell. very well built. And the occupants of the pews down below were saved, one of the fact that the pews had high backs on them. So the gallery laid that down in the gallery at the tops of these pews, but scared the liver out of them. They thought, he was preaching on the wrath of God, and the gallery fell. I mean, that's really dramatic. A young woman who was the greatest company keeper in town, she was a real flit, she professed, she repented, and then others followed, and then the repentance was on. Was it a real revival? Well, yes, among other things. There's a lot of hysteria, a lot of mass psychology. Revivals are hard to define sometimes. Hannah writes, she was followed by many young people. The contagion spread to the elders, to their elders, that is their parents, and soon salvation became the sole topic of interest. Regular business was almost suspended. The meeting house in Parsonage became the center of the town. It was a happy time for Edwards, for the millennium seemed at hand. And then he preached his famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. You ever read it? You had to read it? Or what? What's in the addendum? You have to read it. I read it, but all this is often read in literature classes, in which he says he really dangled the people over the fire and produced a great deal of fear and repentance. Picture that a man was like an arrow in God's bow. The arrow, the bowstring was taut, and God's finger was quivering, and all God had to do was twitch, and the arrow would be released, and man would go straight to hell. Well, people in neighboring towns were in great distress. The revival spread, and you can read about this. People crying for mercy. One man grasping the pillar of the church saying, Mr. Edwards, please stop preaching because it was so powerful. And you can read that. It was quite a revival. Well, and it lasted. For some time, not a long time. Turn to page 141. On page 140, I discussed the theology of the First Great Awakening. It was sort of an inconsistent Calvinism. Yes?
I should probably know this, but what kind of a preacher was Jonathan Edwards? Was he a preacher?
Congregational, I believe. You're that of Church of England. He was congregational. We look on page 141, the decline of the First Awakening. This is a revival that lasts too long. Factors in the decline. Edwards, under Edwards, a young when a person in his congregation, I think it was a woman, I'm not sure, who was under conviction, committed suicide, that kind of put a pall on it, you can guess. Some of the flamboyant tactics of those who were repenting with a great fervor brought the thing to disrepute. It led to a schism in the older churches. It offended the clergy. They very quickly pointed to a lot of backsliding members. And many of his congregation rebelled against the rigorous life that Edwards imposed upon them. It was fun while the revival was going on, but to live, you see, it's fun to go to a meeting and get off. Let me say this to you. And I'm not trying to pass judgment on everything, but one of the characteristics of modern revivalism often is what one author has called emotional self-indulgence. Much of what passes for worship today is not worship at all, in my opinion, but emotional self-indulgence. And it's very fine to go to church and have fun, go to church and have a good time. That's one thing, but to live the discipline of the Christian life day after day after day is something altogether different. When the service was over, a lot of people did not want to live out kind of commitment that they thought about in the service. The followers of Edwards came to be called Newellites. Why? Well, I see Edwardian theology was an inconsistent Calvinism. Edwards was offering salvation to everyone. And according to Calvinism, that's not supposed to be possible. Whitefield was the exception to this decline. He came back to America a few years later. And he got the same kind of reception he got before. He was received as an angel of God. His progress in the countryside was marked by greater and greater crowds and more emotionalism. He discarded dogma for drama. Entirely without those with gestures, laughter, songs, and tears, he carried his audience with him to the realm of pure emotion. That is what I'm saying. The general movement died out in New England colonies, but when Whitefield came back, it was briefly revived for him, but that was about it. Now we come to the American Revolution. I'm not going to cover that as a theological event. That's not all that important. I want to come to page 143 to talk about the Second Great Awakening. The Second Great Awakening. Yes.
I wanted to ask you before you go on. Back in times in the early settlements and like the Kennel's talk, I've been reading about it, and I was just wondering how come back then possessions and stuff were so common, you know, I mean, they were constantly...
Okay, we're going to come to that. It's good. This emotionalism and all
well,
this?
Yeah. Like,
okay.
You don't hear about like that stuff today as much as back then.
Okay, let me deal with that in the second great awakening. We're going to do it. Okay, it's a good question. Let me answer it here. What I want you to learn is that this here's the general movement. That's all we have time for. That when the what I've taught you thus far, that when the New England colonies were established, they were established as model Christian societies. But realities of life set in a number of factors I've talked about, and the spirituality was gone. With Whitefield and Edwards, there was a revival. It didn't last too long. It went down again. And mainly in the Revolutionary War, war was always demoralizing. Revolution, war upsets everything. And so a part of the decline was caused by the Revolutionary War. But then there was time, around 1800 becomes the first Great Awakening, early part of the 1700s, lasted for a while, then dipped down, and it was a long period of decline, Revolutionary Wars from 1776 and following. Like the war was over, we come to about 1800 now, beginning of the next century, there was a second Great Awakening. And this sort of gets us ready for the American Restoration Movement, because the American Restoration Movement in some ways, grew out of the second Great Awakening. Got that? First Great Awakening, Whitefield, Edwards, early part of the 1700s. Decline, Revolutionary War, last part of the 1700s, come to 1800s, second Great Awakening. That help you? So to give you a perspective on time. James McGreevy, was a Presbyterian preacher, was one of the men who started it in Logan County, Kentucky. And he and his congregation prayed for revival things. The life on the frontier was, the average frontiersman was immoral. Life on the frontier was crude, ugly, and worldly. We often picture the frontiersman as being, you know, fighting the wilderness with his rifle in one hand and his Bible in the other. Well, that was true of some after the Great Awakening. But as the frontier moved west, on the vanguard of the frontier, it was always marked by global morality. This revival came in kind of behind the line. And even as it went west. Why? Because that kind of life, often there's a number of reasons for it. People were dislocated, life was hard, people were ignorant, I'd rather run schools, and a lot of the people who went out on the frontier were unstable people anyway. Often not the best people, sometimes they were later on. The best people tended to come later. Do you realize that the American cowboy, the average American cowboy, was an outlaw? When times were good and the economy and the cattle business was good, he was a cowboy. When the prices went down and he was out of a job, he became a crook. And it's one of the interesting things about to read the history of the American cowboy, as the frontier went on beyond Missouri, beyond the Mississippi River, that men like James Wesley Hardin, they are known both as eminent lawmen and as outlaws. They'd outlaw a while and they'd be lawmen for a while. They'd hire them. And most of the great lawmen of the West, in the early days, had been outlaws before or became outlaws later. And some were both at the same time. Very interesting morality. The life was harsh. And so, as the frontier, listen to me, in the early 1700s, the first Great Awakening, it took place in the New England colonies. By the early 1800s, the frontier was in the Mississippi, in the Ohio Valley. It was between the Appalachians and Missouri. The Midwest, we now call it. McGreevy, his statement, I put here in the syllabus, you can read the top of page 143, but a revival broke out, and this produced the famous camp meetings. And this is going to answer your question, Laurie, best we can. The camp meetings were a phenomenon, particularly of the frontier, but they left their mark on American revivalism. What happened was the camp meetings began in Logan County, and look at the statement. In the first years of the new century, Presbyterians, McGreevy, Barton W. Son, and others organized camp meetings in Kentucky. Thousands of rough frontiersmen, emotionally starved and with spiritual longings, camped together for several days to hear preaching and to socialize. It was a toss-up whether more souls were saved than conceived. What were they camping? Understand the campgrounds. And why I'm answering the question, why were there emotional excesses even earlier? You see, people who are not well educated of necessity operate more on emotions. They are less analytical because they are less equipped to analyze, and they are more, you can stampede them emotionally. Now they're accepted, this is a generalization. So the people who are less educated, their religion tends to be more emotional. That's a broad generality. And people, even doing in college, were not that well educated. Common people were not educated at all, hardly. And they lived lives that were, that was one factor. Second factor was they lived lives that were emotionally sterile. That is, there was not the stimulation. Now, I'll just teach you this here, and we'll come back to this next quarter in the restoration of it. Because, you see, life on the frontier was boring, frankly, and dangerous, and hard. And there was very little, and lonely. And people did not have books to read. And so this became, like Frederick Jackson Turner said, the frontier was not, when you say frontier, you're not speaking simply geography, you're speaking sociology, you're speaking anthropology. It's an intellectual phenomenon, and it's left its imprint on America. For instance, the frontiersmen would have to create their own fun. So what they would do, where'd the hayride come from? What they would do is they would have to put their labors together. They would raise a barn and have a barn dance. They'd all have to get together and pool their labors and put up a barn. So whether each man building his own barn, he couldn't, it'd help. So they'd all go build one man's barn and they'd build another man's barn. And they'd go build another one. And they were opening up a new area. And what would they do when they got the barn finished? They'd have a dance. It was an excuse. Square dancing came out of that. When the ladies would get together and make quilts, pool their rags. You know, I'll give you some of mine, you get some of yours, these patchwork quilts. And they'd have a quilting party. It was from Aunt Dinah's quilting party, I was seeing Nellie home, the song says. What's the hayride? They had to make their own fun. A lot of their music, like the American mandolin is an instrument that was made in America. A lot of the instruments, the banjo and the mandolin, if I know what I'm supposed to know about this, they were originally handmade instruments by people who couldn't buy them. The people made their own music, made their own fun, and the camp meeting, was it a religious revival? Yes, but you see, it was the only show in town. As many as one-tenth of the population of Kentucky went to some of these, went to King Ridge, 1 out of 10. Well, what happened was, these camp meetings got started, word would spread, and everybody would come for all kinds of reasons. Preachers would come and they would preach. And they tend to get very emotional. These people who are emotionally starved, they tend to get carried away. They bark and jump and faint. Do you understand that?
Like in the early settlements, that was something just to do. Like have the trial process was just something. So when these marriages would keep somebody being witch and was murdering them.
Well, no, that was just ignorant hysteria. It got started and people believed it. That was that happened in the Middle Ages in Europe a lot. If people are ignorant, they can get led. Once something gets started, hysterical. It's kind of like, by the way, one of the reasons you leave the camp program is to be careful in junior high camp. You get hysteria starting. If one girl starts crying, pretty soon they're all crying, and you get a mess on your hands pretty soon. They're very little bit religious. But it's hysteria. So, very dangerous. Did that answer your question? It's kind of a psychological phenomenon. I don't think it's the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit doesn't make people bark and faint and slobber.
And so today we don't have much because there's more entertainment.
Yeah, people today are not emotionally stopped, like overstimulated in some cases. Anyway, in these phenomena, people would show up, like they say, it was a toss-up whether more souls were saved than conceived.
They would, who would come? Everybody would come
for all kinds of reasons. They'd come trade liquor and bring their, and people had to eat, so people come to sell stuff, and they'd come to meet, and they'd come to trade and to court and to chase women, and they just kind of, it was a combination of religious revival, county fair, family reunion, you know, all rolled into one. And but see, it was the only thing going. People would load their wagons up, come to camp out until the food ran out, and they had to go home. And the old camp meeting, you know, Jimmy Swaggart calls his TV program the camp meeting hour. If he would have been on those camp meetings, he'd call something else. There was about as much immorality as spirituality, you know. There was the spirit, and there were spirits. And there was a toss of it, was more which had the weight. And, well, I can remember, this is a carryover. I can remember when I was a little boy, we'd have revivals back there in the hills. There'd be more people outside the church, wouldn't be in. You'd gather a crowd. And they'd come sit in the parking lot on the car fenders, and on the, across the street on the fence. They'd come to visit. You'd have maybe 100 people, 150 people inside, and another 100 outside who came. They didn't go to church. They came to visit.
But you didn't count.
We had one of the elders of the church. And he was the postman. He delivered corn liquor out of the trunk of his car. And the oldest, one of the oldest churches in Georgia, Spring Hill, President Bell Johnson. In that church. They used to use the church tower to store the white Latin.
The kind of central distribution point.
Why everybody came to revival and you visit your friends and get your week supply of liquor and go home. Come, you know, was it religion?
It's sort of like tent making, though.
Yeah.
Was it the preacher didn't do it necessarily?
Was it really, was there true religion involved, true spirituality? Yeah, and a lot of other things too. It's hard for us to think about that, but you see, I can remember my uncle died back several years ago, back in the 60s, died suddenly. The funeral. There were about three times as many people. People came to that funeral who were very distant. People would go to funerals back then. Even I mean, growing up, they go to funerals because that was a social event. And nobody looked down. You understand? They may only remotely know the person who died, but they knew that at that funeral, you were going to have a lot of their friends were going to be there. That you would never see them all together. Maybe once or twice a year, so they'd go to pay respects for the dead, but not just for that. That's not. There's nothing irreverent about it. I can remember having 200 or 300 people sitting out in the parking lot, around the yelling in the lawn, you know, and talking. And the immediate family went to the funeral parlor. You know. So the frontier produced that kind of mentality, just get together. Well, most spectacular meeting was at Cane Ridge, and we'll come back to this next quarter. 1801, August 1801, there were from 10 to 25,000 people, depending on who you believe. But the problem with counting is nobody really could count because people came and went during the whole period. Ministers of all persuasions were scattered about the grounds and preached simultaneously. And participants could wander from one speaker to another. And you're going to read about camp meeting revivalism if you haven't read it. What were the continuing effects of the camp meeting phenomenon? Number one, a general concern for religion was created. For all the negatives, remember I was trying to teach you that the camp meeting phenomenon, this revival, there was some spirituality involved. It wasn't just all emotionalism. It was many things, including a revival. But there was a general concern for religion. Religion became alive on the frontier. There's all the camp meeting. Talking about God became concerned. The protracted revival meeting was firmly infused into mainstream Protestant methodology. Note this idea of having a, you know what a protracted meeting is? We don't have it anymore, we ought to. Protracted meetings where you would go into a church, and these died out about in Midwestern America even, died out in the 40s and 50s. 1940s and 50s, they pretty well. Protracted meeting. Now we're down to, I got a revival this week in 3 days. It's hard to have. They would have an evangelist in the song. They have in the summertime usually, and try to have them after the planting, you know, after the crops are in, the planting was done between planting and harvest. And they would simply have a speaker in, and they would start a meeting, and they would go until the meeting was over. That is, until the
spirit ran out, people got tired. For time to be, it would go as high as 6-7 weeks sometimes. As long as people were coming, it was good spirit, and they would change their views. My hometown, Bedford, Indiana, First Christian Church is now Disciples, beautiful church. Back in the early, about the 1930s or 20s, S.S. Lackland, who was at that time the editor of the Christian Standard, held a 6 weeks meeting there and baptized 700 people. And when I was a little boy, that church was one of 1,000. I'm lucky they didn't get 100. But that was a real revival, man. And it would literally, it would have effects on the community. Tactical meeting. Well, you see, where did they get this idea? The camp meetings. It was a continuation, in some sense, of the camp meeting. Well, they would set up a meeting, and they didn't say we're going to begin, but they'd say we're going to begin on a certain day, but they never said when they were going to end. They didn't, but they kind of ran out. Everybody had to go home.
How did it continue over word in the middle of revival at St. Cloud, which doesn't seem to be going anywhere? I mean, long.
They can.
Oh, not enough time. I said some week-long revival. I can remember week-long revivals in the 60s and 70s where you had 30 or 40 people coming without a 300-member church.
We didn't need them, but you have one or two.
The thing we need to have real revival is three things. To have it, which we don't have. Number one is more time. Number two is less music. And number three is better preaching. You know, the days of revival meetings are over. That's because we quit. Anything's over if you quit. That's my opinion.
You think that's one of the reasons we've seen such a slackness in the last 20 years?
Yeah. That's more difficult. To be fair, it is 10 times more difficult today to have a long meeting, to have a 2 or 3 week meeting, because life is something more complicated. Back when I was a little boy, even, you could have a meeting and have almost everybody there every night for 2 weeks in a row or 3 weeks in a row. I remember 2 or 3 weeks. I remember Reggie Thomas coming in and having a meeting. And somebody play the saw, they come to this meeting, you have chalk artists and things. But people today are too sophisticated for that. But one of the problems is that back then people would come, almost everybody would come every night because there was nothing else to do. Today, you get the majority of your people, they've got obligations 2 or 3 nights a week. And that, to be fair, I think we can still do it. If you wanted to pay the price to do it. But it's more difficult now because people just have too many other things going. But back then, there was nothing else doing. I mean, I can remember when it was a big thing when an airplane went over. I can remember when an airplane would go over, meet everybody go out of their house and look up.
You know, listen, like,
I was a little boy, Today, you know, space shuttle can go up and nobody even notices. Okay, let's go on. Many churches, we're looking at the bottom of page 143, the continuing effects. One was, there was a general concern for religion. Number two, the revival meeting became fixed in American Protestantism. Third, many churches enjoyed growth in spirit, especially the Baptist and Methodist churches. Fourth, religious individualism led to endless schism. Everybody already talked about this. Everybody's willing to do their own thing. And fifth, the American Restoration Movement in some ways came out of this. We're going to talk about how next quarter. Continue with the Second Great Awakening. The Second Great Awakening started in the Midwest and it spread to the East, back to the older part of America, and into the colleges. Revivals broke out in some of the church, all the colleges were church colleges. Understand that? And revival began to break out in some of these colleges. And Yale had become so worldly that even though it was started by the church, French radicalism, French atheism had pretty well taken over, and English deism, Unitarianism dominated the faculty at Harvard, and so things were in bad shape. Timothy Dwight brought a revival at Yale. He was the grandson of Jonathan Edwards, became president of Yale College in 1795, and this was important because it did turn out a lot of manpower for the pulpit, and a lot of these went west. So even though these revivals did not last, in these colleges, there was enough revival, and there was enough of them, that did produce some notable leaders for the ministry who were very spiritual men. There were 15 periods of revival at Yale, and even one now. In writing of a revival in 1802, a participant recorded, "Wheresoever students are found in their rooms, in the chapel, in the hall, in the college yard, in their walks about the city, the radiant impression was, surely God is in this place. The salvation of the soul was the great subject of conversation and absorbing interest." Jedediah Morris tried to battle Unitarianism at Harvard. He couldn't, so he started a new school called Andover, still in existence. He fought any innovation in theology, any departure from Edwardian theology. The hill upon which it set came to be called Brimstone Hill. One day, the headmaster of this academy addressed the class with this remark after the class was over. "There will now be a prayer meeting. Those who wish to lie down in everlasting burning may go. The rest will stay." If you want to go to hell, you can leave. But those who don't want to go to hell will stay for the prayer meeting. A couple of boys left for their hardy souls. That's pretty extreme, but there was revival. In the West, Oberlin College in Ohio and Knox College in Illinois were founded by men from New England, as I said. The missionary and Bible tract societies were formed. There was a great deal of genuine interest. Now, one historian wrote, "The whole voluntary society apparatus launched a great saturation campaign to save the Mississippi Valley and thus save the nation." What happened was, in the East, where there was more education, came men who were better trained and who were revived, and they produced literature. You see, literature was very expensive, and they began to produce tracts and Bibles for the frontier. And they were sort of, it was a missionary enterprise. It was a missionary enterprise. And so this is what created the Bible Belt. Have you heard of the Bible Belt? This was it. So what happened was, to summarize, it started really with McGreedy in Logan County, and it started in the frontier, Kentucky mainly. It's like a railway, early part of the 1800s. It spread back to the East, mainly in the colleges. But from these colleges, men went to the pulpits of the East and the West and started some colleges and printed Bibles. And so it kind of fed back into the frontier from the East. And this helped sustain the revival. On page 145, I have this summary statement of religion on the frontier. This is very important. Revival and the frontier sickness together. Revival on the frontier was sparked both locally and from the East. I've said that. The isolation of the frontier made settlers eager to participate in any kind of community life. So the church became a social center in a way that it's hard for us to understand sometimes. The Presbyterians were in a good position. Why? Well, they were dug in, but they did not do as well. The Presbyterians did well in the more settled areas. They didn't do as well on the frontier because they were a little too sophisticated. The Baptist groups did well on the frontier because their worship was very simple, their doctrine was very simple, and they used lay preachers. That is, the Baptist churches would use untrained preachers in a way the Presbyterian churches would not. The farmer farms all week and preaches on the weekend. Has always been, listen to me, this idea of the lay preachers, they call it, the comparatively untrained man who's a part-timer sometimes, a guy who maybe he does it full-time, maybe he doesn't, but he's called to preach and he studies the English Bible and does the best he can. This has been, for the Baptist Church, as it was in this period, both a strength and a weakness. It's a strength in a lot of local vitality. A weakness in you get a lot of stuff that's not too scriptural. You see, you get a man who's not well-trained who's getting fervent, and these were good godly men and led sacrificial lives. It can produce good, but it can also produce bad. So it wasn't, as I said, a blessing and a curse. The Methodist Church was the most vigorous. I've already told you why. Because their organization was set up for it. Why? The circuit riding preacher. It was said that only crows and Methodist preachers could be found out in the rain. Got that? Out in the rain. Crows only burned the fire out in the rain. And the Methodist preachers, the only men who, no matter what, you know, and this was quite a scene, these Methodist preachers. They say this about them, especially not just the Methodists, the men of the Methodists. Some Baptists ran circuits too, but the Methodists were, that's the way they did it. You understand, they go from one preaching upon to the other, and if they had, if it was time to go, they went. If the weather was bad, they went anyway. Their horse went lame, they walked. These were heroic men. They didn't live very long. Most of them were single, and they burn out quick, and they die, got sick and died. If you were a Methodist preacher then, you were, you know, it's interesting, today a preacher's a preferred risk, you can get better insurance rates. but not then. These men didn't live very long. A lot of good men gave up their lives. Not just Methodists, but there was some real heroism there. The few Catholics in the West were served by itinerant priests, except in the French settlements. Catholic Church grew usually by immigration, not evangelism. Frontier worship was emotional, for the reasons I've given. Now listen, you understand, I'm not putting that down necessarily. It's like anything else. I would not give a nickel for a man's religion if it did not touch his emotions. There's nothing wrong with emotions. It's the emotionalism that's bad. And, listen to me, the fact that some people are more emotional in their worship than others does not give us grounds for ridiculing them. I'm not trying to ridicule them, I'm trying to understand them. All I'm saying is that less educated people, people live in an emotionally sterile world, tend to get their emotion where they can find it, and in their religion. Now, it can produce negatives, and it often does. But religion, I think in our churches, I think most of our churches would do well to give opportunity for the proper venting of proper emotional immunity. Because I think our churches ought to be more emotional in any case than they are. But not give over to emotionalism. Often, I mean, you know, and just raising your voice and typing your